Hello, everyone. Welcome to Inclusive Collective, the most inclusive of all the collectives, where we bring you news and analysis of the latest in people and workplace culture and share stories and learnings of inclusive people, organizations, and innovation. I'm your co-host, Rob Hadley, people and culture strategist specializing in diversity, equity, inclusion, and people analytics. I'm here with my good friend, Nadia Butt, workplace culture strategist and talent development consultant. Nadia, how the heck are you?
Did you hear me giggling?
Yeah.
You're like the inclusive of all the collectives.
my new goal, just to crack you up as I do the intro. I kind of play with
doesn't
the intro a little
much.
Bit.
It doesn't take much. You do a good job.
It doesn't take much.
Yeah,
it doesn't take much.
That's
great.
I love mostly everything.
I mean, that's kind of the perfect podcast partner, right? Like
true.
Someone that will laugh at the things you say, right?
Oh, it's so true.
How are you? Doing well?
Doing good. Yeah, doing good. I feel like we don't really speak as much anymore.
we're every 2 weeks in this model here. So I think that I do think, and we're very busy, but like I come loaded with like 15 things I want to talk about. And then I'm like, wait, we have to pare this down into a show, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's like, a lot that's happened.
Yeah. And so something I was curious to get your thoughts on was, mm-hmm. Taylor Swift or Beyonce's in terms of double album, right?
Ooh.
This is the question of our time, right?
Yeah. Ooh. That is a question of our time. And I haven't listened to either album yet. So that is something I will have to do. But like, I'm a Swiftie. It's people are probably gonna kill me for saying that, but I like I love Beyonce, but I am like a hardcore Swiftie. So
I don't know.
We'll have to see when I listen to the albums.
Can I tell you that like I was talking to someone who is a huge Beyonce person,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Really, really big Beyonce. Like someone that like if you say, hey, should we listen to music? They're like, yes, we should listen to Beyonce.
Okay.
And I asked how they were receiving the country album.
Yep.
And totally out. Totally just not interested at all. Right. And
so really? It's become
really
a controversial topic, actually.
Yeah.
The Beyonce country genre.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the whole point of the album was to, I mean, I don't
mix it up.
Yeah.
Mix it up.
Yeah. I like
Darius
when artists
Rucker is not going to be representative of black country music. Okay. Yeah,
I like when artists try to go into other genres and try to mix it up a little bit. And so I'm very interested and curious because I also, I have a lot of family that are mostly listeners of country music, and therefore mm-hmm. I would be interested to hear their thoughts.
What
on
their thoughts are? Yeah.
Are
yeah.
you in on that? Is it, right? Because like when you do that, when you take that chance and you go into something that's kind of out of character or outside
totally.
Of your genre,
yeah.
you're uniquely positioned to piss off your own fans and then the fans of the genre that you're stepping into.
Sure.
So I really enjoy that whole dynamic.
I mean, and Taylor did it. She was country and then went into pop. So.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm just going to say, because we're an inclusive collective, but she's white. So was it easier for her to do than a black woman going into country?
I think that going from, white woman going from country to pop music, which is also very white, is pretty easy, right?
Right.
I don't think it's the same hurdle that
barriers aren't the same.
that's my,
all
I'll
right.
have to think deeper about it, but
yeah.
So. Cool.
Well,
extra bonus story for us to talk about.
I love today. It. That's great. The people wanted to hear that. But Rob, this week on Inclusive Collective, we'll be talking to the CEO and founder of the Inclusion Initiative, Grace Foster. We're also going to discuss the MLS's efforts towards DE&I and a few Googlers getting fired over protesting. You'll be raving about Trump's DE&I plan. I intentionally called it that. And I will rant about USC's decision-making skills. But first, let's get to the deets.
Let's talk soccer.
Okay, let's talk soccer.
Let's talk soccer first. And so this is the MLS. This is Major League Soccer. Football, if you're
football
from anywhere outside of North America. So I love this story in the Washington Post this past week of the MLS, what it's doing to improve diversity. So the league has not had a great track record. Most people don't have great track records, and this league in particular in terms of hiring coaches that are representative of the league's players. For example, Nadia, 25% of the league's players are Black. The league has had just 8 Black men as head coaches in its 28-year history. And so the league, I think, is doing some innovative things. It's trying to do something about it. It's using its developmental league called MLS Next Pro, intentionally building diversity into the coaching ranks there to give underrepresented former players a place to cultivate their coaching craft. Okay. In the story, 43% of the head coaches there are either Black or Hispanic Latina, which is a big difference and a big leap, as I said. You know, and then a high percentage of the assistants are also from the non-dominant group. So I love it. What are your thoughts?
Listen, like professional sports, like have this common theme amongst themselves where they like the majority of their players come from a non-dominant group and their coaches or assistant coaches come from the dominant group. So I wasn't surprised when you sent me the article, but I was very happy you sent it to me because one, I don't know if you know this one, but I love football. I like football. I love soccer. My family loves soccer. So I was happy to see that, you know, a sports league is really creating the intentions to like break down those barriers to say racial inequities. I also saw gender inequities because I believe they mentioned like a woman being an assistant coach. You know, I was happy to see that they're focused on recruiting efforts, but also what you had just mentioned, like taking a look at some of the current players and thinking about what succession planning might look like. And that's all part of the employee life cycle. So a really great focus on that. I think my only like question to you is like, what can the MLB, NHL, NFL like take away from the MLS, if anything? And also, fun fact, they're building a soccer arena near my house, like near my home in Boston. So that's kind of fun.
Well, I think there's a fun fact. Utah's getting a hockey team. Did you hear that?
I did not hear that.
I didn't think that. Like, I was thinking of all the things that you could do to make Utah more white. The only thing that you could add would be a hockey team.
That's awkward.
Right?
Yeah, it's very, that's probably
it's very
true,
few
actually.
Things that you could actually put in the mix to make it more white, and hockey team would be one of them.
Oh,
but I think, so you're talking about sports league. I thought about it in terms of even companies can take a lot from this as well.
Absolutely.
From this approach, right? So
sure.
So, you know, I've always said when people are like, well, we just can't. So for whatever reason, we don't have representation at a certain level in our organization. We can't just do fill in the blank. We can't just promote people. We can't just create positions. It's like, no, you can, right? Like you can do things to build up those pipelines. You can get a little bit outside of what we consider your normal organizational structure to figure out how to develop certain groups of talent, right? And so there's almost no creativity, certainly in sports leagues, but even in companies often, right? So they could create a new level of assistant manager. That's what the MLS did here. They essentially added a new layer and they created a management incubator that they could help develop people. And
really
so,
cool.
You know, often the other big thing that happens in corporations is especially with the drive toward efficiency, is they will try to, there was this study from McKinsey many years ago that said that the optimal level of manager to employee relationship or the span of control is 8 people. And so that led to a lot of companies taking out different layers of management.
Yeah.
And those smaller layers of management, so like the assistant director, assistant manager, whatever, that you may manage, you know, 2 to 4 people, those are the places where you can start to build management capabilities. I think that we really have a dearth of management talent because we don't develop it right now.
Yeah,
and so,
you're right.
So you can do that. You can add layers. You can find ways to develop talent and you can be creative. And I think this is just a really good example of that in a sports setting, but it could be happening in a lot of different settings as well.
Yeah, really. That's really true. Yeah, great article. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
All right, Rob. So lots going on as it relates to the protesting of Israel. According to NBC News, at the end of last week, Google workers staged a sit-in protest at the company's offices in Seattle, New York, and Sunnyvale, California, over what's called the Project Nimbus, which is a joint $1.2 billion contract to provide the Israeli government and military with cloud and AI services. Protesters sat in an office of leadership for more than 9 hours, wearing shirts and raising banners that read "No More Genocide for Profit," until they were eventually arrested. 28 people were fired after 9 employees were arrested. And I just want to also mention, like, a Google spokesperson stated that, quote, these protests were part of a longstanding campaign by a group of organizations and people who largely don't work at Google, and then continued to go on to say that, quote, a small number of employee protesters entered and disrupted a few of our locations, physically impeding other employees' work and preventing them from accessing our facilities is a clear violation of our policies and completely unacceptable behavior. After refusing multiple requests to leave the premises, law enforcement was engaged to remove them to ensure office safety. End quote. Thoughts, if any?
I'll be curious to hear what you think. I think that I don't have a problem with the company firing these folks, actually, because they were, you break company policies and you're to the point where you can be arrested, then, you know, the company has the right to enforce their policies.
Sure.
And yeah. I also support what these folks were doing, right? So hopefully they knew, my guess is they knew they were going to get fired. They knew that this is like, you do this, you know, you're going to get fired. Sounds like they pushed it pretty far.
You know, something's going to happen.
Right. And so, and I appreciate them calling attention to this. I would wonder why they're willing, or they, you know, potentially these particular employees were willing to overlook these contracts up until now. The department, and they think about the other Department of Defense contracts that Google has and will have, because a company is the size of Google or Amazon or Microsoft or Apple. So these big behemoths, the only way that they're ever going to be able to grow is to chase big pots of money. And so the defense budget in our country
is
between $800 billion and $1 trillion annually in times of when there is no active conflict that we are actively, you know, whatever, wink, engaged in. So, you know, so Google, you know, has said their policy is we will be doing work for the Department of Defense. Thank you for your feedback. You know, if you don't like it, then you can't be here.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's just a reality that people have to face. If they're in one of these behemoths, you're going to be part of something in almost in any big company. You're going to be part of things you don't like.
Right.
And you need to figure out how to reconcile
like what's your threshold.
What is your threshold? And these people had a threshold here, which I totally understand and can see, and they knew they were going to get fired. So I don't know, I grapple with this a lot, right? Like, because becoming harder and harder to have integrity working with some of the folks that we have to work with sometimes.
I agree. I mean, everything you pointed out, I think is absolutely relevant. And, you know, I think, like, there's a few things. I also don't, like, love the interruption of business, especially if you're going to put your colleagues in danger or, you know, a lot of folks may not agree with what you're protesting against. And so therefore their livelihood, like, they might not want their livelihood at stake. There is definitely this is why we put policies and code of conduct in place. I think I wasn't there, so I recognize that. That's number one. Number two, like, I know that there were protests happening outside, I think, for a number of months now. And this is across the board at several organizations, particularly ones that, you know, have like government contracts and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think what I reflect on is, like, from a leader perspective, like, are there other things that they could have done? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like you said, like, eventually, I think ultimately many of these employees went in knowing that there's consequences, like there's potential they're going to get fired, that they're going to get arrested. That's, you know, maybe the worst things that could happen. But I think of it from a leader perspective. And I think what I would see is like, okay, my employees are in pain. And is there an opportunity for me, if I haven't already, to sit down with them? And even if I may not have the power to change anything that they're requesting, let me just hear them out. Let me hear them out, because they're in pain. And then if, you know, and maybe give them options like, okay, I hear you. I can't do anything. Your options now are you can stay, but you can't create ruckus, or you have the option to leave.
Yeah.
And then, like, consider escalating it to arrest. I don't know. Again, I wasn't there. I recognize that it's easier said than done. I think it's a tough situation all around. But I don't think that this is going to be the first or last time that we hear of sit-ins and protests from employees, because it sounds like this particular Israel-Gaza situation is escalating even more with now the involvement of Iran. So, you know, it's tough all around. And that's, you know, I just wonder if there's other things like leaders could have done at that point. But
yeah, I think and I think that your coaching is broad here, right? Like, so it may not necessarily be what the leaders faced with regard to Google and this particular situation, but you're going to have employees that are either uncomfortable with the work that you're doing, and there's got to be an effective way to do that, especially as, you know, we come in a more interconnected and complicated world. You got to be able to have conversations with these folks and figure out and listen to them and in a constructive way. And
it's, yeah,
I think it works really well.
Yeah. Like, I think of people peacefully protesting like their wages or peacefully protesting their safety conditions and peacefully there's been several protests over the lot, like the Writers Guild, the automotive industry. Like, there's been several protests, and I feel like there was conversations from leadership with these groups, with these unions. Were there sit-ins? I don't know. I don't think so. But part of me is wondering, like, well, you escalated it. This is all I ask, is like, let's reflect on the comparisons of protesting for whatever reason, climate, wages, safety, Israel. Like, why are you differentiating the protests? So that's all I have. You know, it's more of a reflecting. It's not even opinion. It's a reflection question. That's all.
Well, I appreciate it, Nadia. I appreciate you. Let's take a quick break, and we're going to come back. We're going to do some sitting in with Grace Foster when we come back on Inclusive Collective.
Welcome back, folks. Really excited to share that this week on Inclusive Collective Podcast, we welcome the founder and CEO of the Inclusion Initiative, Grace Young Foster. The Inclusion Initiative is a tech platform for professionals that is elevating the future of work for adoptees of color and foster care alumni. Grace is a former nonprofit executive with 15 years of experience in both the corporate and nonprofit sectors. She holds an MBA from NYU Stern School of Business. She also holds an associate's degree in business administration and a BA in communications from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. Grace, we're so excited to have you join us on Inclusive Collective this week. How are you?
Hi, I'm great, Nadia. Thank you so much. That was such a wonderful, beautiful introduction.
I love it.
I'm flattered.
I love it. And I'm so excited to hear more about you and the good work that you've done. So let's just dive into the questions. I'm always, especially when we first met, I was so excited to meet you because of your, you had shared your lived experience with me. And I think that is probably a launching point into a lot of the work that you do or have done. So could you share a little bit more about your background and maybe the components of your identity that led you to creating the Inclusion Initiative?
Yeah, of course. I'm a transracial, transnational adoptee. I also was in the foster care system here in the U.S. after a broken adoption. And what led me to build the Inclusion Initiative was really how my lived experience was such a huge part of me, my development, how I chose my profession, right, in the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. But it's such an under-the-radar identity. It's really unknown, especially in the workplace. And I saw a huge need, a huge gap of resources, but also community. For folks like me with this lived experience.
I'm curious, like, when did you start to kind of notice that maybe there were differences in what you were observing for yourself versus maybe like a friend or a colleague? Was it like throughout your college experience? Was it when you first started working in the workplace? Was it, you know, when was it in your time frame? Or maybe it was when you were younger. I don't know. When do you think it was?
I mean, all the above, being adopted, being in foster care is a very unique experience in this country and internationally too. And you know, I obviously knew that I was different. I stood out in the very white community. Mm-hmm. I had white caretakers, multiple white caretakers. And, you know, I've always known that I was different, right? And I never really truly felt like I belonged anywhere because mm-hmm. I was moving around from home to home. And when I was placed into a home, right, it didn't actually reflect me as a person, right? I didn't see myself reflected in my caretakers mm-hmm. or in the community that I was in. So it started very young, but we all know, right, especially as people of color, when we move into spaces like school, like our, you know, friend groups, like in the workplace, right, that this can happen over and over again.
Sure. You're like reminded of maybe the lack of differences or even just a shared identity that doesn't exist if you're kind of with homogenous groups of people that are of a dominant race or a dominant group of folks.
Exactly. And when we're talking about families too, right? Mm-hmm. Dominant families are birth parents and birth children. And so understanding, right, when you are a foster kid or when you're an adopted person, that's largely, it's a smaller piece of what we think of when we think about family.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's actually quite significant. I mean, every year there are over 390,000 kids in foster care.
Wow.
Uh-huh. Every year there's about 100,000 adoptions that take place. 50,000 of them are from foster care.
And is that U.S. or is that global?
That's U.S.
Oh,
only.
Wow. That's a lot.
So U.S. Wow. only.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these are just estimated numbers, right? Because there's a lot of adoptions that are not reported because they're private. They're private adoptions.
Oh, interesting.
So there's an estimated over 5 million people with this shared lived experience. And so, you know, it's a significant portion of the population, but again, we're largely under the radar, yeah. largely invisible in society, in work, in our schools, mm-hmm. Because it's not really a common identity and right. lived experience that we talk about.
Yeah, and there's all these like intersectional components of the identities too, right? Right, from like a race perspective or gender perspective or geographical location, I'm sure, and et cetera.
Exactly.
And these statistics are so interesting. I'm curious, like, as part of the research that you've done, of course, your own lived experiences, perhaps talking to folks, can you share more about the, like, what types of challenges this community faces in particular in the workplace? Like, what are some of the things, the barriers that they experience or are challenged with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, the Inclusion Initiative, we've launched the first ever study
yep.
for transracial adoptees and foster care alumni in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And this is a community that are made up of predominantly people of color mm-hmm. Within this demographic. And in this study, it was so interesting. And it's, you know, it's ongoing. We hope to scale it. But the initial findings are very, very interesting. And just let me share with you just some of the challenges and barriers,
please.
Like you were asking.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we found. And again, you know, I launched this study because I was having these challenges. I was experiencing these things myself. Mm-hmm. And we just talked about how there's over 5 million plus people with this lived experience
right.
estimated in this yeah. country. Yeah. I believe there's a lot more, actually.
Yeah.
And I knew that if I was going through some of this, that there's going to be more within our population of professionals that are going through this. And so,
sure.
You know, some of the barriers that I inherently believed were... you know, dominant barriers for our community was visibility
mm-hmm.
and access to networks, which we mm-hmm. all know play a huge role in career opportunities and leadership trajectory.
Yeah.
And so our study, and these are, you know, just preliminary findings. And so only 10% feel like there's visibility of our community within their companies.
Oh, wow.
10%. 46% of our respondents said they felt invisible in the workplace within these identities. 58% feel like there's the lack of their networks, both family networks and professional networks, were a barrier to achieving their professional goals.
Oh, wow.
And let me illuminate that further by just sharing that only 6.7% of foster care alumni say they're close with their families. Like, family network, that's a huge support system, right?
Right.
And only 6.7% of foster care alumni feel close to their foster families.
Oh, wow. I don't know why I thought it'd be much larger.
In adulthood, right?
Yeah, right. But
And 33% of transracial adoptees feel close to their families. So these numbers are pretty significant.
They are, yeah.
And 80% do not feel that there are mental health resources for them specifically, right, as transracial adoptees and foster care alumni at work. Mm-hmm. 32% feel like they've been passed over for promotions, raises, advancement opportunities. One-third of this workforce, that's high.
Yeah.
And 50% feel like it has taken them longer than their peers who do not share this lived experience to gain these opportunities and gain these promotions and receive higher compensation at work,
right.
50%, half of this workforce. And so, you know, I knew that I was experiencing and had experienced this in my career journey. And these numbers are telling me, right, that there are many within our community that are experiencing this as well.
It, that must be so validating, like to have your own like lived experiences and then conduct this study and have, you know, significant numbers coming back, sharing kind of the barriers, whether it's networking, the lack of networking opportunities, or the, you know, the lack of mental health resources. What was it validating for you, like the evidence that you ended up, you know, the findings?
Yeah, I mean, it helped me immediately realize I wasn't alone in this.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, I explained this is a largely under the radar community,
right,
a largely under the radar identity, especially in professional, how we present ourselves professionally.
Sure.
So it's super isolating, right?
Of course, yeah.
And
I would imagine
as adoptees of color or as foster care alums, right, we can connect with people based on how we look on the outside. So our races can be a big connecting factor. But when you are a transracial adoptee or you're a foster care alumni who is a person of color, right, and you're placed into a home that doesn't reflect your race or ethnicity, there are so many different experiences and norms and understandings that you have about race and how you identify with race and how you're treated as a person of color who's adopted or in the foster care system. That is not, it's not a shared experience, right, with people who are in same race families. And so it is becomes even more isolating, right? Because, for example, in employee resource groups within your company, you might have a resource group for Black folks, Asian folks, Indigenous folks, right?
Which, but when, you know, definitely
great,
is the case
wonderful.
Across the board. Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's needed.
Yeah.
But when you're an adopted person who hasn't grown up with people who reflect you, your ethnicity, and your race, the way you identify within those communities is very different. Your lived experience is very different. And so the resources and conversations and support you need is different.
So different, yeah.
And because you can't always connect directly, right, those relationship building opportunities, those support systems are often missed for people in our community because there's not that same really shared understanding of lived experience. And so it just, it was validating to your original point, right?
Yeah.
That this is definitely something that's needed for us at work.
Yeah. And I think it also just describes how even when we like bucket people into, say, like a race category, how we're still not a monolithic experience, right?
Right.
Like, so I hope that that's one takeaway that the listeners can kind of gather to from this conversation is, Like what I'm gathering from what you're sharing is, you know, I'm Pakistani, American born, and that might be the same case for someone who's adopted, but our experiences would be very different because of, one, my family life, two, how I was brought up, you know, from a cultural perspective, just varying degrees of opportunities that I may have had or educational opportunities I may have had that maybe the adopted or foster person didn't have, et cetera. And so I think that's like a really, I love that you're able to kind of showcase these barriers. On the flip side of that, though, I'm curious, what are some of the solutions to close on those gaps? And so when I think of like programming or initiatives that you'd like to see come from like employers or organizations for them to consider this community or this group of people, like what are some of those solutions? How do we provide the right programs and or efforts to solve the gaps for this particular group of people?
Yeah, I love that you ask that. And one thing I talk about a lot is the fact that intersectionality impacts all of us, every single person. You identify as more than one thing or one way. And so right there, right, we all have something in common. Mm-hmm. And the more inclusive we can be about diverse identities, like the more visibility, right, we can bring to the diversity of identities, the more unifying we can make our workplaces, the more unifying we can make our teams, because we have more in common than we think, and we share more parallel experiences than we originally think, right? And so there are various experiences that we all go through of exclusion, of invisibility, of loss, of barriers, of trauma. And so pulling back, right, if we step back and see the bigger picture that we all share parallel experiences, we all have intersectionality, you know, we can understand, right, that we can work together and we're stronger together. And so this creates more empathy whole, as a collective. It creates a better sense of belonging if we can see that others have parallel experiences to ours. Even in my example, right, even if someone has not been in foster care, even if someone has not been adopted, but they're a person of color, right? They have their families immigrated to the U.S. just like I did. Like, there are parallel experiences like that. And so that is definitely one more bigger picture thing, right, that organizations, leaders, people in general can do, is just step back, see the intersectionality, bring more awareness to the diversity of different identities. And that's huge, I think.
That is huge. Yeah, it's just really untangling kind of your bias or assumptions and bringing more awareness, like you mentioned. Consider that the intersectionality of, in particular, maybe this group of people. I thank you so much for illuminating and shining a light on adoptees of color, foster care folks, particularly in the workplace, because I have never really considered it before. Which is a shame, because I actually have several friends in my network that are adopted. And I've, you know, after talking to you the first time, I actually had a conversation with one of the friends about their experience of, say, networking opportunities and kind of just advancement opportunities within their organization. And some of the things that you are mentioning now are absolutely the things that they had mentioned. So thank you for bringing that to the surface for us. And we always, you know, ask our guests to provide one resource that you would recommend to our listeners as it relates to, like, you know, DE&I, or perhaps, of course, the topic of adoptees and foster care folks. Is there what would be one thing that you would recommend to our listeners?
Absolutely. So this is not adoptee or foster care alum related, but it's just the bigger conversation of equity, inclusion, diversity. And I follow just an amazing person named Michelle Mi-Jung Kim. Okay. She's Korean-American. She's the award-winning author of The Wake Up, Closing the Gap Between Good Intentions and Real Change.
Okay.
And she's also the founder and CEO of Awaken, which is a firm that, you know, really works with companies and organizations on DEIB issues and really in the issues of equity is a big piece of her platform. Mm-hmm. And she's just an amazing activist. The Wake Up just really challenges, right, maybe the old traditional thinkings of what DEI is.
Sure.
And how to really infuse equity into your efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a thought-provoking, positive, but also a book that really, really challenges not only professionals in the space, mm-hmm. but leaders and just companies as a whole and how they think about this work.
That is great. We'll be sure to share Michelle's book as well. Grace Foster, thank you so much for joining us this week on Inclusive Collective. For folks that want to check out Grace, find her on LinkedIn. Also, you can go to www.theinclusioninitiative.com. Thank you, Grace, so much for the conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Nadia. I really appreciate you having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Same here. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back for our Con Reflections and Raves and Rants. Welcome back, folks. I just finished my conversation with Grace Foster, and we're at that time for Con Reflections, and I am solo today, but I did want to share just, you know, after the conversation with Grace, some of the things that I was just thinking about is how, one, I love that she's collecting data and that there's going to be a study for folks to take, and we'll make sure that when that study is available, that we reshare it so folks that are part of this community can participate and kind of collect more data. So I love that she's collecting the data to understand the lived experiences, understand kind of, you know, the strengths of the community, the areas of where maybe the opportunities are, some gaps, some challenges. And then I love that she saw, you know, through her own lived experience, a gap, and kind of just thought of like innovative ways to really, you know, support on closing the gap. And, you know, just in my honest and humble reflection, I did not know that this community is a community that, of course, they have barriers and there's challenges, but I did not recognize in the workplace that these barriers and challenges existed. And so I was really, I was really honest in my reaction with Grace of just how I'm appreciative of her shining and illuminating a light on this community of folks. So that's my Con Reflection. And I am going to welcome Rob back into our Raves and Rants section of the podcast. And it is that time, so I will go ahead and rant first.
Yeah, let's rant.
It's a ranting type of week. So,
all right, go for it.
I won't make this a long rant. I could, but I'm not going to. But I am very frustrated, particularly at universities and academic institutions. This last week, tensions over Israel and Gaza are still at a high, and at the University of Southern California, they barred its valedictorian, Usna Tabassum, from speaking at next month's commencement ceremony due to her advocacy of humanitarian efforts and on social media and social media posts supporting Palestine. The school cited potential campus safety risks if Usna delivered a speech. People are pissed, and I'll just leave it at that.
People are pissed, and I'll leave it at that. That could be the name of the show. We could just do that.
That's actually a great podcast name. People are pissed, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I'll leave it at that. All right. Well, thanks for that, Nadia. Let's end on a positive note here. So I want to commend the company Truth Social for their inclusive work policies. Truth Social, Nadia, as you know, is, of course, the social media company / meme stock run by the multiple-time indicted former game show host Donald Trump. Truth Social. It was reported, and then I confirmed by checking it out It cites on its website and in its documents its commitment to DEI, saying the board is committed to creating and maintaining a culture of diversity and inclusion. The company will be better able to grow and improve with a diverse board, management, and team of employees.
Ooh.
Such a commitment is and will be a factor in identifying and nominating director candidates going forward.
So, what?
You know, so now this proves, one, that they don't believe their own bullshit.
Yeah.
And two, it shows that you can, even those that most oppose DEI can pay lip service to it when necessary, yeah. Right? So it's easy. They probably have this boilerplate, this document available. Their lawyers drafted up for them.
So it's both infuriating.
It's actually mostly infuriating. But, you know, good job by Truth Social for their inclusive work policies.
That's incredible. Well, Rob, thank you for all of that. That's it for Inclusive Collective this week. Just a reminder that if you're looking for DEI and workplace culture, strategy, consulting, problem solving, or training, you can reach me at Nadia@nasconsultants.com and Rob@Rob@TakanoConsulting.com. Inclusive Collective is a production of Orfilio Media and edited by Ari Matei. We'd love to hear from you folks, so please send us your feedback at inclusivecollective@Orfilio.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn. You can also subscribe to our Inclusive Collective newsletter. If you like what you heard, please be sure to subscribe and rate us 5 stars wherever you listen to your podcasts today. Thanks again to our guest, Grace Foster. And thanks to our listeners. We will be back in a few weeks. Be well.
Bye, Nadia.